I'm so happy to be here to see you all. This, what we're calling right now the post-birth era, because December 22nd, 2012 was simply a marker that something is shifting. And it's very good to choose a time when everybody who would like to converge around that could do so. And Teilhard de Chardin said, evolution is convergence. That's how it happens. So anytime we can get just a bit more connectivity of what's already emerging, something more can happen. And I just want to share one thing about the Birth 2012, December 22nd event that I think would be meaningful here. This came from an inspiration by Teilhard de Chardin, who has been truly the inspiration of my life. And he pointed out in evolution that there is a rise of complexity and consciousness with every outburst of singularity. And I'm going to get to that because my theme they gave me is outburst of singularity, which is a chapter in the book. And I think I've been living through an outburst of singularity, so it's really a perfect subject. And the what I got from Teilhard way back in the 1960s is he said, we are now moving to the next level of complexity, consciousness, and freedom, you know, up from the billions of years of evolution. And he saw God in evolution as the impulse of creation leading to ever higher complexity, consciousness, and freedom. And the minute I heard that, I felt that was right. And I was like maybe in my 30s, in the 1960s. And he said that he felt a time would come when the next level of complexity would arise. And he called it the noosphere, N-O-O-S sphere, the mind sphere. Now, this was before the internet, before we had this vast global brain connecting people at all hundreds of millions of times a minute. He said, at some point, when the noosphere is sufficiently infused with love, it would awaken and get its collective eyes. And that's the global brain, not just our own individual consciousness, but a collective shared awareness. It would get its collective eyes. And he called it the Christification of the earth. In other words, he felt when enough people infused the larger global brain mind with love, it would affect the collective consciousness of everyone. So one of the things that we did that was relatively popular for Birth 2012 was a sign-up sheet right on internet that said 3 days of love. And we invited people for 3 days, December 20th, 21st, and 22nd, to only do acts of love, only think thoughts of love, and infuse the noosphere with love. And there were some of us who felt we were going through a portal. Some of us who did this, because when you do it, of course, you become connected with everybody else who's doing it, wherever they may be. And because it was on internet and people were clicking on it and saying yes and then giving their names and giving various ideas they had, we actually had a very small mini Pentecost. Because everybody who was in an experience of love, while there was internet mainstream TV going on, experienced it. And I think that's one of the things that will lead into my discussion of the new harmony, is the ever-present opportunity to experience the oneness as it is still emergent on the planet. Because it's quite obvious that there's a lot that feels disconnected and disharmonious on the planet. But the beautiful mystery that I think this book, The New Harmony, really emphasizes is that when you yourself place yourself in that harmony and in that love, particularly now because there's so much crisis news, and you begin to feel what's emergent, what's loving, what's creative, and you know that's everywhere too. That is as much everywhere as is the breakdowns. But when you actually experience it, which many of us did because of being called together for this due date, we believe that there was an effect on everybody who was experiencing it. And right after that, when I came back from, I'd been to Byron Bay, Australia, and then I was in Los Angeles, I came back on the 23rd, and I thought, oh, yeah, I had this terrible postpartum blues. I felt really badly. And I, you know, I've had 5 children. And I was saying, where's the baby? What actually did happen? Because it's so intangible. When you're feeling it, it's really there. And it's exalting. But when you step outside of it, and I couldn't get back in because it was too intense, and it also was at a very, I would say, intense and focused scale. So when I was given this wonderful book, The New Harmony, I started to read it, and I truly got back into the harmony. I was overexcited, like a woman who's just had a baby. It's very often that you get depressed. So as I started to read The New Harmony, because of the wonderful gentleness of it, the inclusivity of it, the absolute certainty of the truthfulness of it, without any dogma, without pushing it on anything or any particular way of seeing God or nature, I was so deeply moved. And I could breathe into the experience that Teilhard de Chardin spoke of that thinking layer connecting to the heart, and realize it's omnipresent, it's always there, it never goes away, and every time you experience it, you're adding to it, by the way. So it's growing. So I want to, I think the way I'd like to do this is read certain phrases from his book and then comment on them. So the first one is the intimate experience of the mystery, capital M, for we are one. Just that, as an experiential reality, and he says, it's through each other that we know more of this. Not only do we experience this one individually, but I think what happened to me right after that birth 2012 is I wasn't with others right then, because I had been with people a lot, and suddenly I was alone, and it was harder in that moment. And I was wanting to share how in my own activity I could regain the experience of oneness as more of a steady state. And this I learned so much from Alice, and from, she took me one time, we met week after week after week, and she said, Barbara, I'm going to give you the greatest gift for your vocation, and it's silence, since I'm always talking. And I said, silence? Yes. And so she said, once a week we're going to meet and sit in silence. And I believe there's one person here who was sitting with me in silence. Is that true? More than one. One. Yes. Well, it's in that silence, she said, you're going to find your deeper vocation. And this is a part of the sort of evolutionary process, is that every one of us has a soul's call that is at one with the process of creation, but which is calling us to participate ever more fully. And as an evolutionary soul, I'm always asking, where does that take, where am I meant to express it now? And so it was extremely important to have the silence and the contemplation. And the second part of it for this intimate experience of the mystery is the word resonance. And I don't know if you use that word very much, but what we find is that if you have two or more gathered, there, as Jesus said, there I am in their midst. What is it that's in our midst when we are in resonance with the deep self shared with at least one other? I believe that we start reinforcing that frequency. And currently, what's happening with me is that as I get in resonance with two or more, knowing that the whole planetary body is one with the source of creation, that resonance taps right in to that revelation of oneness. And the oneness seems to be more fully expressed through resonance. And I've also discovered that if you really want to know what your soul's call is in any moment of your life, to be in resonance with two or more, it creates a field of harmony and knowing where you begin to spontaneously know, where the higher mind comes in and the mental mind does not have to analyze it to get it. So the contemplation, the silence, the resonance of two or more within this experience of the mystery reveals more of the mystery, not only of the world, but of your own expression within the mystery. Because each of us is actually an integral part of the process of creation. And here's his next beautiful point. We're tapping in to the forgotten memory of those who have gone before. We carry it in the psychic layer of our minds and our bodies. So let's just really explore that, tapping into the forgotten memory of those who have gone before. I believe what he was focusing on right there was all the men and women and people for all the generations of humanity, and then maybe going back to the origin of life on this planet, and then going back to the formation of Earth. And that's mainly where he takes it. And then we come forward and just imagine ourselves being encoded with the forgotten memory of all of those who came before us. And so what I realized that I want to put that in a context of the forgotten memory, let's go all the way back to the origin of creation. Let's go back, because you can't stop somewhere, actually. If you're really going to have the memory, you would be remembering through the formation of Earth, and then you'd have to back up through the formation of the galaxies and the supernovas and the materials, and then you'd go back to the origin of the Big Bang and before. So what I have discovered, when you start probing into this forgotten memory of those who have gone before, you're going to go back billions of years. You're going to go back to Source, to God, to the infinite mystery. The most mysterious mystery for me is that out of the mind of God, out of the cosmic intelligence, out of the eternal, the silent, should have come an impulse to evolve. And that jump between eternal, one, silence, God, and the impulse of evolution which in the very first 3 seconds was perfect, perfectly designed in order for energy and matter to form. If that explosion had been, they say, even one small degree faster, there would have been no matter or light. And the perfection of first 3 seconds is a complete mystery, but an even greater mystery that it came from no apparent thing at all. Now, I'm just going back and for the forgotten memory, because if you really go back, you're going to go back to that forgotten memory. It's really a very exciting memory, because here is a thought about that from Jean Gebser. He calls it the ever-present origin. So whatever it was that took us from the eternal to the evolving is in you and me right now. And that has been called by some evolutionaries the inner Big Bang, which is a nice thought. Whatever it was that brought that brought existence from nothing at all to that original beginning. If we're going to go tapping into the forgotten memory of those who have gone before, and we imagine it's everything that has gone before, we're going to come up through those billions of years that is actually coded in every atom, molecule, cell, organ, reptilian brain, mammalian brain, neocortex, cortex. We are a complete whole embodiment of the entire process of creation incarnate. And if any of us could possibly even remember that, we would have jumped into what I call true evolutionary consciousness. And there is an observation, since the subject is outbursts of singularity, if you look at the billions of years, what you see is singularity after singularity after singularity. In other words, nature takes jumps. Excuse me. Nature takes jumps. And there's currently, I mean, there are many different ways of saying this, but some people have said, okay, the first singularity was the Big Bang. That's a totally amazing mystery. But the mystery is continued in everyone, in every second, actually, because it's always evolving. So the second Big Bang, some have said, is the origin of Earth, just from the point of view of our local life pattern. So the origin of Earth itself, think what it took to get to Earth. You had to have the energy and the matter and the galaxies and the explosions and the formation of matter. I mean, it is truly awesome. So let's say that's the second Big Bang. It is said that the third Big Bang is life becoming aware of itself. I mean, that the universe is coming alive in that Big Bang of the origin of life. So then we're getting to us, which is the possibility of the next Big Bang, is that in life forms such as humans, we are becoming conscious of the whole process of creation that is now and has been and will be in every moment creating us, and feeling some level of responsibility and participation in the story of creation. That is being called, by me at least, the fourth Big Bang. I think it's the jump from self-conscious humans, when we became self-reflective, to humans being aware that we are evolution embodied in ourselves as expressions of the divine impulse of creation that came out of no thing at all, or the mind of God. Now, if we just breathe into that mystery for a moment, it is so awesome. And one of the things I most love about that mystery is quoted from Isaiah. I am about to do a new thing now. It springs forth. Do you not perceive it? He quotes Isaiah in that. And that's exactly what the Leadership Conference on Women Religious had as their entire theme for that conference when they had to respond to the Vatican's orders to disband or reform. We had a wonderful evening with Sister Judy Cawley and myself to tell you the story of being there. And me being invited by the 60,000 women that are Catholic women who are part of the Leadership Conference to actually go the whole way with my understanding of Teilhard de Chardin and all of that, because they want to be moving forward. I mean, it was a remarkable experience. So just to get back to the fourth Big Bang, let's say we're in a fourth turn on the spiral of singularity. And as we go a little further, I would like to describe what I think that is. But a singularity is as great a jump as from non-life to life. I mean, that's huge. Or let's say from single-celled life to animal life. Or from animal life to human life. And none of those jumps could have been predicted from the state before itself. However, if you gain evolutionary eyes of the whole mystery story of creation, if you just open the evolutionary eyes, you see this, because actually it's science-based now. It doesn't take a mystical revelation, because the scientists have discovered the timing of that particular more objective aspect of the story of creation. So when we say yes to this singularity, where human life is gaining consciousness of the whole universal story and realizing that we are in the story, it's not just about the story, we are the story. Then, if you look back to the mystery of how, you might say, the evolving aspect of the divine made it through for billions of years to arrive at beings like ourselves on this little earth that actually experience ourselves as participants in this, it seems to me that we get a clue about, you might say, the intention, direction, or nature of the divine. Could it be to create beings ever more in the image of God? Could it be that that early phrase in the Old Testament is exactly right? We are being created in the image of God. And what is God but creator? Not only the eternal aspect of God, but obviously the creative aspect. It's phenomenally creative, the entire universe, everything. From the protons and the electrons and the atoms. I went to a big event of Ken Wilber's, you know, who is a great evolutionary philosopher, and it was on the theme of the, I don't remember the exact name, but the creativity of the universe. And it's a very important word to apply here about the mystery and the harmony and the oneness is the creativity. And if and when we embody the creativity that is in that inner Big Bang of always expressing more consciousness, more freedom, more harmonious order, if we are incarnating that tendency of that universal process of creation, what starts to happen is, for me, and anybody like this, is an immense inner expression of love. of gratitude for the divine process of creation, of awesome wonder that we should have incarnated as this, and that we should be fortunate enough to live at the very moment in human history when we are aware we are affecting our own evolution and could be destroying our life support system, as taking it as an evolutionary driver to help us see what we're creating at a higher order than where we were before. Because behold, I'm making all things new. Behold, I've done nothing but singularities, you could say. Isaiah didn't say that, but this is... I think he would have. He probably would have if he was here. If he were here, Isaiah would be right with this story. And by the way, so would most of the Jewish Christian culture. The Judeo-Christian culture is one of always seeing more. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep. We shall all be changed. That's St. Paul. I am totally inspired by the spiritual impulse of evolution that's embedded in the Judeo-Christian culture. And because we've just hit the moment of evolutionary choice of destroying our own life support system or choosing to self and social evolution in a new way that we have not fully seen before, because we've never had a global culture that had to do this. Never. Therefore, not only is God making all things new outside of us, but making all things new within us. That after that birth, many of us who were part of it were saying, what is being born? If it's true that anything new is being born, what is it? And so it starts out with what's being born in you personally. And then what's being born in the larger world. So that's a very big question, which we won't take time to go into. But as I was constantly asking it for myself in that whole Christmas holiday season right after this birth celebration, I began to feel inside me this whole being. And we talk about wholeness and oneness of the earth and the earth life and all of life and all of existence. So what really had to happen for me was that all the different aspects of my nature, local self, essential self, higher self, Christ, whatever levels of being one has, how does that become whole so you can be born as a whole being, which is a really nice, simple phrase for it, in whom the essence of this process of creation, the mystery of time past going forward, starts to activate. And I do think, Alice, when you introduced me as being inspired by the idea of a universal human and a universal humanity, one definition of a universal human would be one connected to the heart, to this whole process of creation. And this takes me to the next sentence that I like so much from this book. God, he sees, as the presence at the heart of all life as love. Now that is a really, if you take the longer evolutionary story, not just the more recent human life story, and you think that out of the silence, out of nothing at all, the burst toward, from the eternal to the evolving, must have been love. Because why else would God do this? It's an effort. It really is. And there are the philosophies who say only the eternal is real. I've never believed that, because I think to deny the magnificent process of creation and everything that it took to get us to be here with our eyes and our ears and our thumbs thinking of ourselves as participating in the story, that's where you fall down in total gratitude and awe at the creative process of universal evolution. And God as the presence at the heart of all life, deep in the human soul, he says, there's a return to the true center of everything that has been. And I've added, and is now unfolding. So let's just dwell in there for a moment. Return to the true center of everything. Now let's take a big everything here. When I say everything, I'd like to go all the way back to the mind of God, to the eternal. Return to the true center of everything that has been and is now unfolding. And he goes on, the birthing process is love. The universe is radically relational. And that is a very important insight to dwell on. Because it's one thing to look at all of this enormous process of creation as just a magnificent intelligence, but you don't necessarily feel related to it, nor do you feel love, because actually the process of evolution is very, very difficult. And hundreds of millions of species way before we were extincting species are now extinct, and they were in the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth. And this is the only one where the people or the beings participating in it are doing it, like the numbers of species that are now going extinct. What's really new for us is to say, let's stop that. I'd just like to point that out of people who always feel how guilty we are as humans to be doing what we're doing. It's true once we know we're doing it. But now that we know we're doing it, we're the first species ever on Earth to say, let's not kill. Let's not extinct other species. And let's be deeply grateful that that love has arisen in millions and millions of humans. That's really a new thing, love one another. You know, with Jesus and Buddha, that whole thing of loving the neighbor as yourself is a huge evolutionary jump that we're still attempting to understand. But I want to go back here. Return to the true center of everything that has been and is now unfolding. And I'm calling it the subjective experience of the developmental process of the whole story of creation. A subjective. If you want to return to the true center of everything that has been and is now, what are you returning to? I would say you're returning to the eternal aspect of the divine within that has an impulse to evolve as you. It doesn't just show up in others. It shows up internally. Because the impulse of evolution is always toward more consciousness, towards more life. That's a multi-billion-year trend. You could actually put that in the front page of the New York Times. Is the multi-billion-year trend is toward higher consciousness, greater freedom, and more synergistic order. And I'll just make a little aside here. I also believe anything going in that direction is the new mainstream. Sometimes people have said to me, Barbara, well, why aren't you more mainstream? Like, even the Catholics didn't know about the planetary birth. Okay. you are a lot more mainstream than I am. However, I would like to claim for all of us the new mainstream. You wouldn't be in Word and Life if you weren't that. You wouldn't be reading all these books if you weren't that. Not everybody's reading all these books. But the ones who are, I'm claiming new mainstream, because the mainstream of evolution is always going toward higher order, greater complexity, greater freedom, and anyone who's anywhere near going in that direction, that's the evolutionary mainstream. Does that make sense? And it helps when you might feel just a little off, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing that, or maybe, you know, I've done enough, or maybe I don't want to explore that. If you say yes to it, you'll find the impulse of the new mainstream within you, which is the impulse of self-expression. And so the subjective expression of the divine impulse, he says, there is a matter, M-A-T-E-R, or living matrix from which the universe has come. Okay, there's another really big insight if you're thinking of this whole story of creation, the sacred story. What is the living matrix from which the universe has come? What is that? I think of it as a pattern or a fractal, is the word they use in a more mathematical way, is that it appears that there are recurring patterns in this evolutionary story that particularly reveal themselves at times of singularity. Singularity meaning like a jump from pre-life to life, or animal to human, or human to, let's say, a co-creative human fully incarnating the process of creation. Let's say we're approaching a singularity within ourselves to be able to do this. So the matrix that I feel is present in everyone, particularly at the time of the jumps or the singularities or the quantum shifts, is that the pattern of connectivity of separate parts to make a new whole starts animating within you. And this love of wholeness, of oneness, of connectivity, of all of us being members of this. I'm going to get this up just a little bit, Alice. Can I put it up? Because I realize I'm down in order to get to the microphone. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's better. Thank you, Tom. So the matrix at the time of singularities, particularly the time of an outburst of singularity, and I'm suggesting we're in one now, would be the, because the tendency in evolution is towards greater connectivity, greater wholeness, greater oneness, of separate parts coming together to make a whole greater than and different from the sum of its parts. Nature is a series of jumps in greater wholeness. Now the oneness may be the eternal, but the wholeness is constantly jumping, like from you know, an atom to a molecule to a cell. Think of the jumps in wholeness. And nature is constantly selecting for what cooperates best. So the matrix at the time of singularities is the impulse toward the connectivity of separate parts to make them come together into a greater whole, which has more consciousness, more freedom, and more order. Does that make sense as a sort of an inner pattern of nature? Are we feeling that? The desire to connect separate parts so that all these, and the new harmony that Philip is his first name. Philip speaks, John Philip. He actually is imbued with the matrix. He is experiencing, in every word he writes, and I wish I had been able to meet him, that he is a living expression of the matrix, both of the internal sort of already present oneness, but his desire to connect all the different parts and not to see them as separate. Not to see them as, this is different from me. And his love of Bede Griffiths, his love of the centering of all of this, is remarkable. And I would say that the matrix that is assisting us in participating in the singularity of our generation is connecting the separate parts within ourselves. That's why I think I was moving towards a greater inner wholeness of being internally with all those separate parts, and then the greater connectivity within our families, within our communities, and then you can expand it into the world. And let's just jump one step ahead to Teilhard de Chardin again, the noosphere getting its collective eyes, connecting heart with heart and center with center. The thought here is that the really great new singularity would be enough consciousness on this earth of enough people to feel the oneness. And the new whole system that's made out of that has not existed before. Wholeness is newness. It's really important to bring the concept of the new into the concept of the whole and the one. Because evidently, the evidence is God loves to create. There's just no denying it. And I love this phrase from Brian Swim. He says, the universe always wants more. It could have been satisfied with hydrogen, says Brian. Great! It was wonderful. No. It had to have galaxies and this and that. It could have been satisfied with Earth. No. In comes bacteria. Bacteria are amazing creatures. They actually took all of that rock and turned it into life. And they had genetic exchanges, and according to Elizabeth Sartoris, they're a lot brighter than we are. But anyway, they they did all that. Now, what did that? Who did that? The bacteria are obviously imbued with the intelligence of creation, but they may not be conscious that they're imbued with it. That's the big difference. So we are, supposedly at least, more conscious that we are imbued not only with the eternal God, but with the evolving Godhead. Because why? He made all of us creative. So that's a theory there. Now, I'd like to go into... So if the universe, he says, the birthing process is love. So how... Am I finished, Alice? Okay. I'm not even near finished yet, so I have to get... I think I'm straying from the points here. All right, I'm going to jump to write this one. This is from his quote from Teilhard. Teilhard... saw a movement from his first view was crimson of matter, which is to say he saw everything in matter as sacred. He saw matter itself as sacred. He saw, because God is infused into every aspect of the creation, and so the material world itself, which at that time, he was never published by the church in his lifetime, because they saw a complete separation between God and nature and evolution. And he saw nature and evolution as a complete expression of the divine. Now, obviously, that's now taking hold. He was a great pioneer. So he said, but Teilhard himself went from the crimson of matter, which is a lovely phrase, that matter itself is becoming alive, or is alive, to the incandescence of someone. The universe is relational. Now that is quite a jump, and I've had trouble with that myself, because I can get the crimson of matter in the whole process of evolution, which is the divine intelligence going through it all. But to see it as someone, internalized in the entire process of creation, not just in you and me, but from the eternal to the evolving aspect of the divine. That one, I have loved to talk about this when we do our discussion, is how do we experience God as one in the process of creation? And what does that, it's not the personal God of the old, at least the old way. And Jesus embodies it. So one of the things I'd really like to ask all of you when we are in our discussion is how you experience the one relational, in relationship with, as a relational experience within the whole process of creation. And I'll share how it is for me, and I'm going to jump right to this wonderful point, which is he speaks of the new Pentecost. And he says, we are living the new awareness of life's essential oneness. And I'm sure that you all remember the incredible importance of the first Pentecost, which when the disciples were in the upper room after Jesus' death, resurrection, ascension, promise, but it was very frightening to be speaking of this at all at that time. And when they were in the upper room, the story goes in Acts that these frightened disciples began to feel light coming through, and they began to speak in such a way that as people of different languages gathered, they were saying, they must have just been so excited that people started to throng into this place, that people were hearing what they said in their own language. But the disciples were speaking Galilean. They all spoke that from, as they were Galileans. And somebody got up and said, how is this possible? We are hearing in our own language and you are all Galileans. We must be drunk. And this is a wonderful phrase. Peter said, no, we can't be drunk because it's 9 a.m. I thought that was a real insight into the lifestyle. But he said, this is what was prophesied by the prophet Joel. At the last days, the Lord will pour spirit on all flesh. And your young men will see visions, and your old men will dream dreams, and even the women were able to experience this. So, that was when that first Pentecost happened, the people who had been frightened and obscure in the world were so empowered with the Holy Spirit of the Pentecost. See, that's why the Pentecostals, I really love them. They bring it down in. They left with the powers of a natural Christ. They could heal. They could break the bonds of prison. They assembled throngs of people from being frightened and unable to dare to hardly express this. They were able to express it everywhere, and that's how the church got founded, by the first Pentecost. So the new Pentecost, what would that be? And I've called it a planetary Pentecost. A planetary Pentecost would be a time when enough of us experience spirit from within, speaking of it in our own language, our own images, our own words, such that everybody could hear everybody else, no matter what language or images we were using. And we would have what he calls a new awareness of life's essential oneness. And that essential oneness would be, if you can just imagine it for one moment, what happened to those early disciples able to have the courage of the heart and soul and spirit to speak the words that changed the world? How many of us can gain from the new Pentecost, the inner courage, heart, and spirit to speak the words that can be understood by all and change the world for the higher consciousness, greater freedom, and more complex order. Can we be the new disciples too? Thank you.